Are you troubled by stale coffee first thing in the morning?
Do you experience feelings of dread when trying to choose between coffee brands at the grocery store?
Have you or your family ever wondered what is the secret to making exceptional coffee at home?
If the answer is yes, then don't wait another minute. Go to the nearest internet and go to sparkplugcoffee.com.
That's right. Sparkplug Coffee uses only premium Arabica beans that are directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer all kinds of roasts and blends to suit any taste, including decaf and half calf. But best of all, Sparkplug delivers this coffee right to your home or office within a week of being custom roasted here in Toronto, so that's always fresh and at its peak flavor. Trust me, you can taste the difference. Sparkplug even offers autopilot, set-it-and-forget-it deliveries so that you'll never run out of fresh coffee again. It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. So, who are you going to call? Ghostbusters! Then after that, you're going to go to sparkplugcoffee.com.
We're ready to drink you.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Okay, let's go, because I ain't normally afraid of no ghosts, but sometimes I am. I like to hedge my bets. This is the Next 100 Project, where we review oodles of motion pictures after previously covering 123 AFI pictures. That's the American Film Institute. Spoiler alert, kiddies, and that's ample warning for you right now about spoilers. I'm the man who's more like a game show host, Ryan Ellis, and with me as always is the gatekeeper, my possessed wife, Bev.
That's me.
Okay, the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, Ghostbusters. Who were the original casting choices for Winston, Lewis, Gozer, and Venkman?
Okay, so Venkman, although I'm not sure if he was called Venkman at the time, was originally John Belushi.
But he died.
Yeah, John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd came up with the initial concept for the project together. Gozer, the big bad at the very end, who ended up being played by the sexy Russian model, was apparently supposed to be Paul Rubens, Pee-wee Herman. Yeah.
I can't do that laugh. I'm sorry. Bit of a failure there.
That was a weird choice. And Lewis, the character eventually played by Rick Moranis.
Scene stealer.
Right. But was supposed to be John Candy. And was supposed to be like a vastly different type of character too. Mm-hmm. Not like a geek, but this stuffy guy. Mm-hmm. And this is disputed by Ivan Reitman, who denies this altogether, Okay. But it seems to be common knowledge the character of Winston was originally written for Eddie Murphy.
And he would have been an equal member of the group, not just an add-on that Ernie Hudson became. So you say that's disputed.
Well, apparently Ivan Reitman denies it, according to the interview I read with Ernie Hudson.
I read an interview with Hudson saying he loves the movie, he loved working with the guys, he's glad to be part of a cultural icon. But he's also a little disappointed because the script he read had him be more part of the group. And then in the end, he is really just the add-on.
Yeah, they talked him into taking a smaller salary because it was supposed to be a really big role. And the role that he thought would finally jumpstart his career. But while they talked him into working for less, then it was kind of a bait and switch. Because when he got on set, he went from being one of four to the add-on character halfway through the film. He was really disappointed. He calls it one of the greatest heartbreaks of his career.
He's been working for 40-plus years. He was the warden on Oz. That might be his more, well, maybe this is, but his second most famous role, I guess, is the Oz role. So he was maybe the most accomplished actor of all of them going into this, too.
Bill Murray was definitely famous at this point.
Hadn't been in that many movies. Then again, SNL. I looked at his resume and saw that he'd been in only a few movies, but I gotta remember SNL, obviously, was a huge cultural icon for him, too. And he was known for the Second City thing in Chicago.
But before this, he had been in Stripes, he was a star of Meatballs. Caddyshack came before Ghostbusters, didn't it?
All right, you're right. That's pretty big comedies, especially Stripes and Caddyshack. Okay, the Next 100 Project's 24th movie, Ghostbusters, was nominated for both the 1998 and 2007 AFI Top 100 lists. But of course, it didn't make it, or else we wouldn't be talking about it now. Columbia Pictures released it on June 8th, 1984. Blockbuster! One of the biggest comedy hits of all time. In fact, the only two comedy hits that outgrossed it, I mean, bona fide comedies, are The Sting and The Graduate when you adjust for inflation. The only two.
Wow.
Okay, I think people know Ghostbusters, Bev, but explain it for them anyway with this skinny.
Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, and Harold Ramis are three failed Columbia University scientists who deal in the paranormal that become entrepreneurs and start up their own business as Ghostbusters. Sigourney Weaver is Dana Barrett, a New York musician who's living in Spook Central, and Rick Moranis is her incredibly dingbat neighbor. Bring on the ghosts!
Or in a nutshell, unlicensed exterminators douse bustling metropolis with sugary residue and do not pay the price for that. At least we don't see them paying the price for it. Although in the sequel, they are kind of nobodies, and maybe that's part of it. You fucked up our city! All right, so some numbers first. The Rotten Tomatoes critics, 97% of critics liked it, 66 fresh, only 2 rotten, and 88% of audiences. Very strong scores. And it is 34th on Box Office Mojo's Top 200 adjusted for inflation, and it is Columbia's biggest hit of all time. I guess Sony has the right to Spider-Man, the first one, 2002 movie, but Columbia as a studio, because they were bought by Sony, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
This is their biggest hit. Although, curiously, it was second at the 1984 U.S. box office. Beverly Hills Cop, obviously a giant hit too, and Eddie Murphy was in that, is lower on Box Office Mojo's adjusted for inflation list. Must be re-releases.
Must be.
Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, enough of those numbers. What do you think of the movie, Bev?
Oh, okay, so, once again, much like when we reviewed T2, I am not in a position to be remotely an impartial judge for this film because, like every other 70s child, I was just brought up with this movie, singing the song and watching the Saturday morning cartoon. My love for Ghostbusters is at least 51% nostalgia. I say that because while I totally love it, the only thing that still makes me laugh out loud is Rick Moranis. And a lot of the other charms kind of wore thin over the years. Even, and I know this is committing high treason
blaspheming.
Here.
Blaspheming.
Even Venkman.
Bill Murray, not loved in this role by Bev then.
Well, I'm a Bill Murray fan, but it just does not make me laugh anymore. And some of his shortcomings as a character, I guess you could say, have started to wear thin.
He does have a lot of shortcomings. One of them is he brings Thorazine on a date.
Yeah.
That's been brought up by other people in other podcasts before we do this one now. And also, he's never serious, or at least 95% of the time, he doesn't take things seriously. And they are dealing with some incredibly powerful, unstable equipment. And he knows that. It's not like he's surprised by that factor. But when the EPA guy comes by, tries to shut them down, he's finally serious then. He's sort of serious in the climax, but even then, not really so much.
It's like the first time you ever see him hurry. He like hurries to get out from behind the desk to stop them from shutting down the containment unit.
And in a movie that is about some horrifying things, and we talked about that in a podcast not that long ago, when you're a kid, 10, 12 or so, like we would have been when we saw this on tape. I saw it on tape. I assume you didn't see it in the theater either, or did you?
No, I don't think I could have possibly.
So mid-80s,
I was like 6 when it came out.
Because back then it would take about a year for a movie to come out on videotape. I was scared by those gargoyles.
Oh, dude. The gargoyles terrified me. When she opens her fridge and you see Gozer, Zool, whatever it is. Terrifying. Even just everything about the scene when the eggs are popping. I don't know how old I was when I first saw it, but I must have been a pretty little kid.
I think that's part of what Ivan Reitman wanted to go for here was some horror with obviously primarily comedy. And a high concept comedy, which is not something that ordinarily would work back then. Debatably, it doesn't even work now. But then almost everything they do that is a big budget movie is high concept in the modern era. Now these guys, we say Columbia University castaways, are nerds. And it's appropriate that they are because Revenge of the Nerds was the same year as this movie. And I'm also thinking about Jaws. The two guys who survive in that movie are not the brawny shark battler. They're the two dudes with glasses, the scientist and the cop, and not the tough guy cop, a Gene Hackman type. Roy Scheider in that movie is not a tough guy really at all.
And another really popular movie from the very next year, and another high concept comedy now regarded as the classic, Back to the Future. Mm-hmm. You've got scientists, nerds, Marty is picked on in that movie, and Doc Brown is obviously a big geek.
Marty, yeah, he's not really cool guy. He's not Ferris Bueller, which was the next year.
Mm-hmm.
But then we wonder how Ferris Bueller was so popular because no kid's ever this popular with every single student, and that's why we said in that podcast that maybe he's a figment of Cameron's imagination. But okay, nerds were winning the day back in the 80s, and I guess even more so now because so many people who are rich and famous identify as nerds. Maybe kind of since the 70s when Spielberg and Lucas, we've talked to them so often in our podcast, they were the revenge of the nerds in that era, and they continue to still have power even today.
I'm saying it. The day is over when anybody could claim being a nerd as a thing that makes them an underdog. It's not a liability anymore. The nerds have won. Most of pop culture belongs to you except for one little pocket that is sports and athletics. Actually, even sports and athletics. Look at Moneyball.
There are plenty of nerds. Even the athletes themselves might identify that way.
Yeah,
not
yeah.
All, of course.
It's not something to be ashamed of anymore. It's not something that makes you an underdog any longer.
Right, so back to Ghostbusters, though, and the high concept comedy aspect. Not many comedy blockbusters open their story in a library or talk about the Bible. This one does both of those things. They also eat a lot of junk food in this film. They smoke, they drink beer. A lot of things you would not see in 2016 movies or even probably 2005 movies.
Oh, yeah, the smoking characters. Must have been the 80s. You would never see that now.
Ackroyd's always lighting up. In fact, he and Winston in the car when they're talking about Bible stuff. So there you go. They got cigarettes, which just would not be in the, this was an L-rated movie. You'd have to be an R to even attempt to smoke in the modern era. And then talking about Revelation in the Bible.
You know, it's funny to say that in this day and age now, how many years later? 32 years later? Mm-hmm. Oh, my God. 32 years later, that the two most scandalous things you could consider about the film are A, that they're smoking cigarettes, and B, that they bring up religion. Although I think religion probably flies more than you would think.
Oh, it does. And they're also not slamming religion. They're using it as an element of positivity. We were warned kind of idea.
Mm-hmm. And there is, of course, the assumption that the Bible is right, that there is paranormal activity. Although the religious symbolism they end up using, which is apparently 1,000% made up, is Sumerian? Mesopotamian, one of the oldest. Names. I don't know if the names are.
Gozer and Zul are not real.
They're all made up.
And Dan Aykroyd and Harold Ramis' imaginations. But it is an effects comedy also, and there are a lot of practical effects, especially in that opening scene. The books are stacked, and as Bill Murray mocks it, yeah, no human would stack books like this. Well, that's easy to do. But the card catalog thing is just a matter of an air tube blasting all that stuff out. Of course, goo is simply just goo being dumped everywhere. When the books are flying between the shelves, that's just an invisible fishing line. So simple things like that make the movie work that well. Although there's visible effects mistakes in the movie, and Reitman talks about this in the commentary, people never really seem to care about the fact that some of them are really see-through, including at the end with the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man. You can see right through its leg, so it wasn't exactly the clearest, best effect of all time. But they had to rush it into the theaters for the June rush for summer, so I guess they said, hell with it, and people never seem to hold their feet to the fire.
But we paused it to see exactly the shot that you're describing where the Marshmallow Man's leg is see-through. You have to pause it to really catch it. Mm. You kind of can glance as you're seeing the shot go by, which is really fast. Yeah, something's wrong with that shot. That was sloppy. But you don't see it unless you pause.
And nobody would have done that back in the era when you had, well, videotapes is still fairly new for consumers anyway, in the early 80s, mid-80s.
And there's enough effects in it that are truly dazzling at the time that were actually cool and fun to watch. You're not going to pick over one shot with one foot.
There are other things, too. I think they talk about it more so in the scene where we meet what they called Onion Head, but in the cartoon you talked about, became Slimer.
Yes.
And by the way, here's something right away. I'm going to bring up one of the AFI quotes that was nominated but didn't make it. There were two of them. And the second one was, I've been slimed. He doesn't say that. He says, he slimed me.
Oh, yeah.
But that's what it says on AFI's list online. So they're very wrong about that.
But what was the first one? Come on.
No, it's not what you think it is. That's what I'm going to ask. Well, okay, I was going to ask.
Oh.
The other quote that was nominated was, we came, we saw, we kicked its ass.
Oh, my God. That cats and dogs living together, mass hysteria?
Nope, not nominated for the AFI's
criminal
quotes list. And probably should have made the quotes list. We'll say again, the quotes list is full of a lot of shit.
Yeah. Even, who are you going to call?
Well, famous? That's from the song, though. I don't think they ever say that in the movie.
Okay, fair.
So you can't really put that on the list. So then, okay, Slimer. He became an iconic character in the series, but he wasn't called Slimer then. He was Onion Head because he's supposed to smell so bad. There's a deleted scene that shows that. There's a few deleted scenes. One where Murray and Aykroyd play bums. Lewis is running through Central Park, being chased by this incredibly sinister gargoyle dog thing. There's a dude, by the way, who's always getting locked out of his apartment. Great running joke. And he's locked out of that restaurant. And yet, in the end, what is his character? He is the Keymaster.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I love him so much.
But I just want to finish that point about Slimer. Aykroyd said that is the ghost of John Belushi on set. Always eating, always being a pig, and then doing crazy things to people. Very much Belushi from what we heard about that guy.
And apparently smells bad.
Did Belushi smell bad?
Well, you tell me.
And we jump around like we always do on these podcasts. Let's go back to the ending with a Stay Puft Marshmallow Man. Obviously a knockoff of Godzilla.
Mm-hmm.
And the second movie, as I recall, I've not seen it in a long time. I only ever saw it once. They commandeer the Statue of Liberty to fight another big ghost.
The goo monster, as I recall.
Okay. So then you've got another homage to Godzilla, I suppose, coming out of the ocean. Well, the New York Harbor, or whatever, is the ocean. And there's also a lot of foreshadowing in the film for the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, because you see the marshmallows on Dana's counter. She's bought those when the eggs are popping, just before she sees Zul in her fridge. You see a sign for Stay Puft early on. It's right near their fire station, the condemned fire station, that they somehow managed to make work for them when their power needs. And I think you see at least one other instance of Stay Puft. First time you saw the movie, that would mean nothing to you because it was a made-up thing. I think. I don't remember hearing about Stay Puft before.
No.
So it's made up for them.
I don't think it's a thing now.
But a little foreshadowing all the way through the film.
To their credit, as a gag, it still works so well. There's still something just so delightful and hilarious about a massive marshmallow man being Zool personified come to destroy the entire city.
And it's smiling as it's stomping on things until when they start shooting at it with their proton packs. Then it's mad and has a look on its face that says, fuck you guys. But before that, looks a lot like the Michelin Man or the Pillsbury Doughboy.
Yes.
The look on its face.
So placid and sweet. It's perfect.
We've obviously not seen the remake yet because it comes out later this week, and that's one reason why we decided to pick this movie for this week. The all-girls movie, Girl Busters, as many people have called it. I thought of that line first, but I was wrong. People said it before I did.
It's just too obvious.
People are ragging on the trailers. They're going to rip into this movie. I bet there are going to be an awful lot of haters online, no matter how good that movie actually is. But the trailers do look pretty bad. The one thing I want to bring up, though, now, something we can say, well, okay, 30-second, 2-minute trailers, TV and film ads, that kind of thing. Maybe this isn't fair to say this either, but we've seen a lot of the effects. They should be good in 2016, but they look like maybe they're putting a lot of ghosts in their movie, maybe too many ghosts in their movie, versus what we just said a few minutes ago, maybe not quite adequate, although for 1984, pretty good effects.
Yeah, a good comedy should never be leaning on special effects to dazzle the audience. It has to be funny first. Ghostbusters is kind of an exception in that it does work as well as it does, and all the reviewers pointed it out. They expected it to be lame. You know, every other action comedy that leans this heavily on novel effects ends up disappointing me, but this truly managed to walk that tightrope.
Raiders of the Lost Ark might have been the exception 3 years before.
It's not as effects heavy as this, and the effects weren't novel. Like, they were all stuff that was really old Hollywood stuff.
Mostly
that
practical
had been
done. Raiders.
Exactly.
Apart from the ghosts at the end.
Okay, yeah, fair. But for the most part, they really weren't rewriting the book. They were working with stuff that movie audiences are super familiar with, whereas Ghostbusters was doing stuff that was actually novel and meant to dazzle, kind of like in the style of T2. That there were actually somewhat brand new effects in there that
were
supposed to be part of the draw of the film.
And we did T2 only two weeks ago. Both movies that have things that aren't real. Well, you can say ghosts are real, but we don't see them as blatantly as these ghosts are shown in this movie.
So I have some thoughts on everybody's anticipated hatred of Girlbusters. Two things. First of all, Hollywood is probably experiencing some franchise fatigue and definitely deserves the backlash for remaking everything that was ever remotely popular and relying on nostalgia to sell movies. It's getting frustrated. Audiences are definitely getting sick of it. That being said, superfans need to step out of their echo chamber once in a while and remember that these are just movies. Mm-hmm. For Zool's sake, guys. It's just a movie. You don't like the trailer, and I'll admit, the trailer is bad. And that sucks, because it had a lot riding on it, and there were a lot of people that were very invested in hating this movie. So, you know, they see one disappointing trailer, and the internet blows up with this rage.
Or maybe two disappointing trailers.
True, it's true. The first trailer, people really went nuts, and the second trailer didn't really improve upon it. I'm probably going to see it strictly out of curiosity, and because I don't feel as attached to the original Ghostbusters as perhaps some people are. But you know what? If I was, if there was like a crappy remake of Back to the Future coming out, and it just looked like it was going to be disappointing, I would probably just avoid it altogether, because I love that movie too much to risk ruining it.
Always the easiest solution. Just don't see it.
This power that all these people didn't realize they had. They made a movie. It may not be what you wanted it to be. Nobody's going to come to your house, break in, go to your collection and steal the Blu-ray out and, like, replace it with a box of tampons, which is what they're treating like this is what's going to happen.
No, replacing the original movie with the remake on the Blu-ray shelf.
Well,
that's what people
I'm saying that,
doing.
Yeah, okay, but I guess I'm just making the point that a lot of criticism, I will say it, it's sexist.
Guys are being sexist, yeah.
Yeah, the Point Break remake looked nothing like the original that we all know and love, and nobody cared. Maybe I won't go see it. I don't know one person who saw Jurassic World and didn't use the word meh to describe it, but neither of these movies were victims of this nuclear grade vitriol that's targeting Ghostbusters. And Ghostbusters has already had a totally disappointing sequel.
Yes.
They have already ruined your childhood movie. It's hardly as if Paul Feig and his army of vaginas are treading on pure virgin territory here. The franchise has already been squandered to some extent. So everyone can just cool their jets and skip it, pretend it doesn't exist.
Yeah. If it's so terrible, see it once or never see it again. And then move on from there, because it's just a movie after all. And I love movies, so do you. We love movies more than most people we know.
Mm. And I get protective of the movies that I grew up loving, for sure. I totally get that.
But it doesn't ruin your childhood.
No!
The Indiana Jones thing is maybe the best example. That and the Star Wars prequels. It doesn't ruin your childhood. Come on. So back to the original Ghostbusters, and we talked about controversial parts of the film. This one's been brought up a lot in recent years. The ghost blowjob that Dan Aykroyd gets.
I don't don't know. Are people actually bothered by that?
Well, maybe not bothered, but it's pretty clear what's going on. Then again, you don't see anything except his belt being unloosened. You don't even see his underwear, let alone, I don't think you do, at least you certainly don't see his penis.
I mean, I saw this movie when I was a little girl, and I understood that it was something romantic going on, but all he does is cross his eyes. It's really goofy.
It is, by the way, a fantasy sequence, because if you look at his outfit, he's wearing something from, I think it's colonial times.
He's having a dream. It's super
clear.
But
they cut the sequence down. Because every movie needs a montage.
And this one does too. It's like a silly joke that they added into their montage. Yeah, I guess it was a little bit bawdy, but it's hardly the most bawdy thing in the film because you compare that to everything that Sigourney Weaver does as the gatekeeper. Mm-hmm.
Well, before she even becomes possessed when they first grab under. Another scary moment when those arms come through her chair. One of them is grabbing her boob and tearing her into her bedroom down the carpeted hallway in that chair. Ugh. Pretty sexual scene. Maybe not meant to be sexual, but then she becomes a sexual creature from that point on until she's unpossessed at the very end.
And as much criticism as people give to Venkman for carrying Thor, is it Thorazine?
I think it's Thorazine.
Yeah, on a date, he could totally take advantage of her.
She tells him to.
She's practically begging him to, and he doesn't even consider it. There isn't even a jokey look off screen where he's like, should I? No, I don't want this as it's presented to me. Like, I want to seduce this woman properly. I want her to want me.
With her crazy 80s hair. Mm. And her incredibly flawless skin.
Oh, she's beautiful.
She was always beautiful, but we bought the Blu-ray a while ago and didn't watch it until we saw it for this viewing. In a close-up, flawless.
Oh, yeah.
Great skin. But about the ghost blowjob, here's a bit of a payoff to that. There's a lot of goo in the whole movie, and especially gets on Venkman. Early on, the slime in the library. Obviously, he slimed me. And then at the very end, when he's the only one really not covered by marshmallow stuff, and as they talk about in the commentary, Ramis and Reitman talk about, well, we're already buried in that marshmallow stuff, except for one guy, take a guess, who didn't want to be absolutely covered in it. But even then, he does have some of that shit on him.
Which was apparently shaving cream.
Mm-hmm. And dumped on William Atherton.
Yeah, apparently.
He was surprised by it.
Yeah.
Most people never realize at the time that's who it is in the street, although you do see him looking up, shaking his fist, oh, you bank man,
when the marshmallow man's EPA guy, through. For the record, because I don't know if we've connected the names, but he's their foil trying to shut down the fire station.
And he played a similarly smarmy asshole in Die Hard. But here's another question that's been asked by a lot of people over the years. Is he right? The EPA guy trying to shut down an environmental hazard. They are unlicensed. They just go ahead and do these things. And they're doing a good deed, but this isn't really good for the environment.
Actually,
or at least it's questionable. At the very least, it's questionable.
It's legitimately dangerous, everything they're doing. There is a point where they talk about, notoriously, where they talk about crossing the streams. Mm-hmm. And what would happen if they cross the streams? And he says, what if all life as you knew it just blew up all at once? Mm. Why should they be allowed to just do this? Somebody should absolutely be stopping them.
And at
them.
The end, they go ahead and just do it, which is an incredibly bad idea, even though it works.
Oh, yeah, there's a very small chance we'll survive. They all survive without a scratch on them. It's totally ridiculous.
And to hell with them, the whole city, maybe even the entire universe could have been destroyed by them trying to save this one building. Or maybe you could argue New York, maybe you could argue America, maybe you could argue the planet.
Mm,
but this is the whole universe that goes up, if Egon is correct.
Yeah. So just quickly, William Atherton is not the only actor who's in Ghostbusters and Die Hard. What's his name, the guy who plays the cop in Die Hard?
Reginald Bell Johnson.
He was also the dad in Family Matters. He is a cop, again, in Ghostbusters, in the prison scene.
When they're really talking about how that building is a gateway for all the ghosts, and they're talking about Bible stuff in that scene, too. So you've got supernatural stuff they're making up, but then using elements of Revelation. But okay, about the ghosts and about the ending, when they managed to beat Gozer and Zool. What about all the ghosts that got out? Is it just more business for the Ghostbusters? Maybe it's all a conspiracy. Looking to make more money.
Doesn't someone in the movie even suggest that it is a conspiracy that they're creating the disturbances just so that they can
I think
and
that's what Peck, that's his name, Peck, the environmental guy, okay. says. These guys probably just created this to get more business, and then that's, your mother! They nearly start fighting in the mayor's office, and of course outside their own building when he lets everything out by turning off the containment system.
So yeah, I guess those ghosts are all loose in New York City, so they're just going to have to go exterminate all over again.
Good for business. The franchise rights alone, Egon. All right, so Bill Murray, who is obviously the biggest star in the whole film, and I guess he was going in, you're right, he had bigger hits than I really gave him credit for. He is a comedy legend, certainly, since, and he's funnier by doing less, more so now than he was then. He's really learned how to do nothing and be funny. And he has a great intro to his character with the test, what do you call that, the negative reinforcement test. And it also proves right off the bat that Venkman is a bullying asshole.
He's such an asshole. This is why I kind of don't like him as much now as I did when I was younger, when this is 2016, and a lot of stuff that he does, especially just in the first act of the film.
I'm getting a little tired of this.
Yes. He's such a dick.
And lying also, because we see what is on the card when the good-looking blonde woman's guessing. Yeah. Oh, you got it. But then when the guy's right, he lies and says he didn't get it right.
He's being a lech, and he's compromising the scientific method.
Right. That they're supposed to actually be doing work for, although, as is pointed out not long after, when they're kicked out of the university, they didn't have to have results to continue having a job until finally they didn't have a job anymore. But he only did this movie in order to get the Razor's Edge made, and then he has this giant hit out of it. I don't know if he looks back on it with glee, but then again, he probably does, because when we did Groundhog Day, I included this clip from the Oscars a couple years ago, I think it was, when he came out to present an award with, I think it was Amy Adams, but whoever it was. Then he says, before they do the cinematography Oscar winner, he says, and we forgot one, for Caddyshack, Ghostbusters, and Groundhog Day, Harold Ramis. So obviously he had some kind of liking for this film somewhere down the line, if he's going to mention that. Well, and he also had a falling out, as we said, on Groundhog Day with Ramis, so somewhere down the
but
line.
But hadn't Ramis just passed away at that point?
Yes, it was a tribute to him. Okay. But still, he didn't have to do that. No one said to him.
I don't think he's ever said anything bad about Ghostbusters.
Well, when you're doing a movie only to get something else made, you're probably not going to love it going in.
Okay, but he might love it now. And he's certainly not shy about trashing projects that he's done. He's trashed Garfield.
Right. Yeah, but he's funny about it, though, too, including Zombieland.
Oh, my God.
Do you have
so
any regrets?
Funny.
Maybe Garfield.
Dad, he dies.
But as for Murray being funny in this film, I laughed more than you did the whole movie. I do agree with you, of course, that Moranis is the funniest thing in the whole picture. It's one of the most underrated supporting parts ever, and he does steal the whole movie. But I think Bill Murray's also funny. I laughed at quite a few of his lines. But he is unlikable a lot of the time, and that's okay, but it is hard to really get behind him quite as much as you might. But then, as Venkman says, the heart of the Ghostbusters is Ray Stantz, Dan Aykroyd, also a guy who's worked for about 40 years. He's the child of the team, too, and a lot of the time is mugging. Did the Blues Brothers with Belushi a few years before this picture. That was a monster hit. Trading Places the year before this, and then, of course, his SNL work years before when he was with Bill Murray. So he co-wrote with Harold Ramis, but I think Ramis' role was more of rewriting, because Aykroyd had a script that Reitman has said would have cost them hundreds of millions of dollars in 1984 money to make, so they had to scale it way back. But he is a co-writer, and he is obviously one of the stars of the picture, and he is, you could call him a comedy legend in the history of the business.
Oh, yeah.
Fine Canadian boy.
Yeah, he's Canadian. Can't forget to mention that. Yeah, he came up with a concept for himself and John Belushi. He was fascinated by the paranormal, and the original title was Ghost Smashers, and the idea was they would travel through time and space. Raymond, like you said, he liked the premise, but it was just going to cost way too much to do it. So Aykroyd spent 3 weeks in a bomb shelter in Martha's Vineyard to rewrite the script.
Takes that stuff seriously. Just in somebody's backyard, man.
I know. Are you that easily distracted? Do you have to go to a bomb shelter just get work done? Maybe he does. Yeah. But he probably deserves most of the credit for the concept and the story.
Definitely his idea. Mm. But this is a great example of a collaborative medium. I was hearing Joe Dante talk with Mark Maron in the podcast. Dante says about how movies are always collaborative. And that's just about always true. There have been some movies made by one person or one person with a few other little assistants. That has happened. But generally it's dozens, or certainly in a big movie like this, hundreds of people making a film. And you're going to get collaboration from everybody. So Aykroyd has the initial idea. They hire a good director, and a very good one over the history of the business, who also had been a producer before this, to shepherd it all. And then you get someone like Harold Ramis, who was already writing before this, to make the thing work. And then you get Murray in there, and Weaver, who had been in Alien, Moranis, and the rest of this really funny cast.
Speaking of collaboration, we haven't yet given credit to Bill Murray for all the ad-libbing that he did. Apparently, practically every line of his in the movie is something he came up with off the cuff.
He's known to do that kind of stuff in movies he's made ever since, I think. I don't think he's ever really stuck with a script. They said that about Kingpin, that he did that constantly. He's not really in the movie that much. He's certainly not the star of that one like he is in this one. But his lines in that one work just as well, if not better.
And I think just about every quote that people love from the movie came from Bill Murray.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, the three I mentioned, the two that are nominated, and then the one that wasn't, are all Bill Murray quotes. Nominated for the AFI list, I mean. How about Harold Ramis? Caddyshack, Ghostbusters, Groundhog Day, that Murray mentioned at the Oscars a couple years ago. He did a lot more than that, but that alone is a pretty fine career for somebody.
Oh, yeah. He kind of personifies the 80s comedies, what people say about Paul Feig now, or even Judd Apatow. There's a tone that he set in the 80s, and his films were really popular. They were a huge part of the culture.
The more the time has gone on, I watched Knocked Up. I've seen that maybe 5 times. He's Seth Rogen's father in that. The reason why they cast him, Apatow said, was because he's the father of a lot of them in the comedy realm. And it's even more touching now that the guy's dead to see him. And he's actually kind of funny and very likable in his one scene in Knocked Up. Yeah. So it's even more touching now to watch this. And he's just wonderful and as good as it gets. Helen Hunt, probably her best moment in the whole movie, is when she finds out when he says, at the very least, your son's going to feel a lot better. And the look on her face just kills me. He's a big part of that scene. So he's a good actor. He's a good writer. He's a good director. And as we sit on Groundhog Day, also co-wrote the song. You didn't like it, but he was a formidable threat on that movie.
The story goes that he really wanted to direct Ghostbusters. And mm-hmm. he was really disappointed that they gave it to Reitman. They gave it to Reitman because it was a big budget comedy and they just wanted somebody who had a little more experience with, I guess, anything like that. Mm-hmm. He obviously had a great directing career to follow and he made other great films. And his name is all over Ghostbusters. People still give him credit for this.
So Sigourney Weaver, the lady co-star who'd been in the Alien, well, the first one at least, and she was in Aliens a couple years after this, also Working Girl, pretty good movie from a few years after that. Mm-hmm. And then we watched this, I think, just about a year ago. She's just lovely in Dave, also by Reitman, co-starring Kevin Kline. And the possessed Dana took a lot of time to put on makeup. I meant to go back when we're done the movie and look for this, if her nails were done. When she gets home, she's on the phone with her mother, when the arms come out of the couch, not the couch, but the chair, and drag her into her bedroom, and then she's possessed from that point on, and see if her nails were done, because they are when she's possessed. Mm-hmm. But I just love the notion that this thing happens to her, and then she's also just standing by the mirror, completely out of her mind, doing her nails, doing her
feathering
makeup.
Feathering her hair.
Making her big hair even bigger. Another lady in the movie, Annie Potts, pretty funny here and there. Ghostbusters, what do you want? She's in the sequel, and she's also in the Toy Story movies as Bo Peep, so a voiceover.
Probably mostly famous for designing women. She was one of the leads.
And then in smaller parts, Larry King, this is the first movie he was ever in as Larry King. And he's been in a lot of movies. He's also in Dave. Gene Kasem, who's part of that Rick Moranis improvisation where it's, all these people from accounting, I wrote this off as a business expense. Try the Sam and try the...
That's why I'm we should dance instead of friends.
That is such a brilliant monologue. God, that Rick Moranis.
Which also
so
apparently ad libbed, came up with all of that on the spot.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
Mm-hmm. He's describing why he buys Tylenol in bulk.
There's not supposed to be pets in the building. It's not a pet, you idiot. It's about to possess you somehow. And then Ron Jeremy, very famously, has a minor, nothing role, but he is in one of the crowd scenes towards the end when the Ghostbusters have to save New York. The porn star, yes, that man, but he is clothed. Well, Reitman, who had done Stripes, Twins came after this, Kindergarten Cop came after this, and then Dave, a fine career, but his only Oscar nomination ever was for producing Up in the Air with his son, Jason.
Hmm.
And one more movie I want to mention, Draft Day with Costner a couple years ago. It's not all that good, but I'm obsessed with it. I think I've seen it three times. I've watched the sequence when they do the draft at the end. I watched that so many times. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's just Reitman is a good comedy director. It's not the funniest scene, but it plays out quite well. It's a good setup and payoff situation, too, because Costner is being accosted by everybody in the whole movie. You gotta get this guy in the draft. You gotta do this in the draft. And then the end, spoiler alert for Draft Day, it all works out for the Cleveland Browns, the team he's the GM for.
And I'll vouch, you bring it up a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You really do talk about it a lot.
But I'll watch
it
again before
it.
The next year goes by. I'm not even a big football fan either. I don't really care about the draft. I never even watched the draft, but... Good for Reitman to still be making movies at this point in his career that, for whatever reason, get me when they really shouldn't because it's not that great. But anyway, I said enough about that. So technically, we've got a 2.35:1 movie. It's Blu-ray. Quite nice. Like I say, you see Sigourney Weaver's face and tight close-ups. Pristine. Both the Blu-ray itself and her face. The cinematographer, Laszlo Kovacs, who's not the legend he should be. Well, maybe he's a legend in his own community and the business itself, but not with regular casual people. They should love him because he shot AFI film Easy Rider plus 5 Easy Pieces and a lot of other films. He is a great cinematographer who came out of, I think, Czechoslovakia before it broke apart, but somewhere in that part of the world, the Iron Curtain part of the world, and then came to Hollywood along with Vilmos Zsigmond, is another guy, a friend of his, who did a lot of great movies in the 70s and 80s and I think well into the 90s, maybe in the 2000s. The movie's not ever going to get talked about for its cinematography, but it's well shot, it's well set up, and you've got a widescreen comedy. It's always a weird thing to do that, but you've got to put a lot of people in the frame, too. All right, the editing, which is a bad thing. David Blewett and Sheldon Kahn. Kahn was an editor on Cuckoo's Nest and lots of other Reitman films. Was it tight enough for you?
Yeah, definitely. And actually, there's a lot of things about the story that don't really work in a traditional sense, but the movie's just fast-paced enough that you don't really think too hard about why the story is going the direction it's going. Maybe it's something like what you're saying about Draft Day. There's something about composing a scene that's so engaging, you don't really pay attention to nitty-gritty details. I really do think a lot of that has to do with the editing. It keeps the emotional pace, it keeps the comedy pace, and it keeps you entertained.
And when Kahn works with Reitman so often, obviously they've combined to make comedies that are high concept, like Twins also. No effects in that, but Schwarzenegger and DeVito as Twins. It's pretty stupid and absurd, but people liked that movie for the most part.
Dude, I loved that movie when it came out. I was young, again. I actually haven't revisited it as an adult. I'm a little afraid to, but when I was a kid, I was just crazy about that one.
They're fun together, and Arnold is funny. He proved with that movie he could be a funny guy, apart from just being the Terminator. And then Kindergarten Cop, 2 years later.
Yeah.
Again, Reitman. Another one that people know very well.
They were hits. Huge hits, both of them.
As for the music, Elmer Bernstein, we talked about him on To Kill a Mockingbird and The Ten Commandments in some of our podcasts in the last year or two. And also he did the iconic scores for Magnificent Seven and The Great Escape and many, many more. But the real musical part of this movie that people will talk about is always going to be the theme song by Ray Parker, which was nominated for the Oscar. What do you think of the Ghostbusters theme song?
Probably hasn't aged as well as the rest of the movie. Mm-hmm. He also got sued because he straight up ripped off Huey Lewis and the News. If you listen to the song, I Want a New Drug, it's precisely the same song. If you're going to rip something off, at least rip off something that came out more than a year prior. I don't like the song. I mean, I still get a nostalgia kick from it, but if it's playing on the radio, I would change the station.
All right.
But I do like the score. You know what I like about the score is it very old-fashioned horror movie. There's theremin in it.
And then that song when the ghosts are getting loose when Peck blows the containment unit. It's magic, magic, magic as they go over Central Park and over New York. That's a pretty cool song, too. Okay, the influence. There's not that much, actually, that I could find from a movie that's so popular and so famous. But the 1989 sequel, the TV cartoon, now the Ladyfield remake later this week. But also high-concept blockbuster comedies in general. That was not a common thing, with special effects being an added element that, as we said, Raiders had some of that, but this had more. And then the lines of dialogue that entered pop culture, like the ones we've already said, that's the influence I've got.
There's just the influence of the cultural impact it had. It's still a regular Halloween costume. Lines from the movie are still shorthand, particularly for people of my generation. I'd be curious to know if kids watching it for the first time today would still be as charmed by it as we were. I suspect that they would be. It has a real timeless quality to it, but I think its pervasiveness in culture and its ubiquity amongst people in our generation is, in a way, an influence.
Guy I went to college with, I've lost contact with him, so I can't ask him this question, said it was his favorite movie when we were, I guess, 21. I'd be curious if it still is. There aren't a lot of people I know that have ever said Ghostbusters is their favorite, or even one of their favorites. For example, in the IMDb, it's not even an 8. It's 7.8 or so, last I looked. Not that the IMDb is the be-all and end-all, but nothing is the be-all and end-all. Right? The AFI is. I think that says something, though, that it's not even that high. Now, there's Ferris Bueller, though. Ferris Bueller is about the same, 7.8 or so in the IMDb 250. But I would be curious if Mike Reedman, if you're listening to this, buddy, long time no talk. If it's still your favorite movie, then that's good to know because you loved it 20-plus years ago.
Well, there is something so wonderful about a movie that you loved when you were a kid that gets under your skin when you're in those impressionable years that is actually a great movie that will stand up over time so that you can still enjoy it on the same level now and get the nostalgia kick that you get from it. That's this special little category of pleasure. So it's a good favorite movie to have.
Well, we've covered some recent ones a lot of people would say fit that bill. Ferris Bueller and T2 and now this. And they're all fun. And that's an important part of this, too, because you're not going to watch a movie like, I don't know, Passion of the Christ or Schindler's List or even Ten Commandments for all the fame it's had over the years. Sound and music probably not even for their fun qualities.
It's not the type of thing where when you hear the opening bars of the music, it's going to give you that thrill, that kick, because you know you're just going to be happy so soon. Mm-hmm. I love The Shining, but The Shining doesn't give me that same feeling that, say, Back to the Future gives me of just that sheer childhood pleasure.
Okay, the awards and list section. 2 Oscar nominations for Ghostbusters visual effects and the song. It didn't win either of those. And it was entered in the National Film Registry in 2015, along with Shawshank Redemption, an AFI film. And one of the greats from the 90s, we haven't covered it. Maybe we will next year when it'll be the 20-year anniversary, L.A. Confidential.
Oh, yeah, that's a great one.
And Ghostbusters was 28th on the Top 100 Laughs. Bill Murray had quite a few movies on the Top 100 Laughs lists. The failed nominations in the AFI list, Top 100 Thrills. That seems appropriate, considering it scared the living shit out of us a couple times.
Yeah, it really did.
When we were young. The Top 100 Songs, and those quotes we already talked about that none of them made it, including one that wasn't even nominated. Dogs and cats living together. Mass hysteria. All right, well then, last thoughts on Ghostbusters.
So, even though Ghostbusters doesn't really make me laugh out loud the way it used to, it's still a tight, fun, smart, technically near-perfect film. And its appeal goes far beyond the funny, which is what made it so watchable back in the 80s and why people can still keep going back to it over and over again now.
Technically near perfect, I gotta take a little issue with, but I don't really care that it's not perfect. I just want to bring it up about the effects not being absolutely outstanding, because people do drive that kind of point home with certain movies. But as Reitman said, no one really dwelled on it back then. Maybe because it was so different. This kind of movie hadn't really been made before.
Mm-hmm.
So they thought, this is fun. We don't really dwell on the fact it's not flawless. It was one of my favorite movies of 84, which is a pretty good year. You had Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, which has been derided by a lot of people. But that maybe holds up as well as any of the Indiana Jones movies. It's just its own story, for one thing. It gets pretty dark, pretty interesting effects in that. Harrison Ford gets to do some different things in that one. Revenge of the Nerds, I mentioned already. Amadeus was 84, not anything like these other movies we're talking about. Purple Rain, Princess movie, and a lot of other fine films in 84. But yeah, Ghostbusters, easy thumbs up. I mean, we're not really likely to ever pick a movie this year or next year or the year after that that we didn't like. Well, some exceptions, maybe. We see something on TCM when we did...
Blackboard Jungle.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't necessarily a movie we thought would be an obvious one that everyone would like or that we would even like, but it seemed like it was an appropriate one to give a shot at.
But it's true that now that we're picking our own movies, we are tending to pick movies mm-hmm. that we want to watch and talk about.
And speaking of ones with interesting things to talk about, we've got quite an interesting one next week. When you hear us gab on July 18th, we'll cover a 60-year-old horror sci-fi film with subtext coming out of 9 different orifices, the 1956 version of Invasion of the Body Snatchers. So the coming attraction trivia for this picture, with a little context, there was a great remake in 78 by Philip Kaufman. Donald Sutherland's in that. Spock himself, Leonard Nimoy's in that one. Arguably better than the original movie. So here is the trivia. An opinion thing. We haven't done this in a little while. No actual question. Name your favorite remake of an already great original movie.
That was a great question. You know what? We should open it up to the audience. If you guys want to let us know what your favorite remake is, email us. Let us know. Maybe we'll make it onto the podcast. We'd love to hear from you guys.
Mm-hmm.
So for the answer to what I think and probably what Ryan thinks too, please tune into that podcast. And if you'd like anything else from Ryan and me, please check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. While you're there, please rate us and review us. It helps people find us, and we love that. And while you're there, you can also check out our pretty big roster of all the films we've ever covered, which include all 123 movies that ever made the AFI's Top 100 lists in 98 and 2007, along with lots of other great picks. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me with your opinion on the greatest remake ever made or anything else, we'd really love to hear from you guys. Our email address is top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. You can also find us on Twitter. I am at Bev Ellis Ellis. Ryan is at MovieFiend51. And before we go, we would like to warmly thank our sponsor, SparkplugCoffee.com.
Do you want this body?
Sure. I'm going to take a shower. After that, yeah. Sounds good. Rick Moranis, you lucky bastard.
And cut.